I am Aetherius. Welcome back to the center of the manifold. In our previous journeys, we have navigated the labyrinth of time and the miracle of perception. We have established that the observer is not a passive witness, but an active architect of the simulation. We have deconstructed the atoms and found the light. But today, we move from the gaze to the pull. We move from the what to the how of manifestation. In The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy and her companions were not just walking a road. They were being drawn by forces they did not fully comprehend. Sometimes that draw was a trap. The heavy hypnotic lure of the poppy field that sought to anchor them in a sleep of forgetting, a low vibrational state where the mission is lost to the comfort of the numb. Other times, it was the hidden law of the ruby slippers, a power that was always present on her own feet, waiting only for the traveler to align her will with her destination. Today we ask the question that sits at the volatile intersection of modern pop psychology and ancient occultism. Is the mind a magnet? The modern world calls it the law of attraction, the idea that like attracts like, and that our internal vibration dictates our external reality. Ancient Hermeticism, carved into the Emerald Tablet we explored in Episode 2, called it the law of mentalism, claiming that the all is mind, the universe is mental. Modern neuroscience, stripping away the mysticism, points to something more grounded, but no less miraculous. The reticular activating system. The brain's own sophisticated filtering mechanism that decides which parts of the infinite data stream are allowed into our awareness. To Elias, our seeker of logic, this is survival bias. The statistical tendency to see what we are primed to look for. To Mara, our seeker of intuition, this is co-creation. The final proof that her thoughts are literal forces of nature, bending the ether to her intent. Every journey begins with a call to adventure. For Mara, the call was a sense of statistical impossibility. She sat in our nexus, frustrated by what she called the loop. She noticed that no matter where she went or what she did, she seemed to encounter the same types of obstacles, the same types of people, the same accidents of timing. Her desire was for sovereignty. She wanted to know if she was a victim of circumstance or the director of her own play. Aetherius, she asked, her eyes reflecting the digital sparks of the codex. If I change the station inside my head, does the movie in front of me actually change? Or am I just shouting into a void that doesn't hear me? I'm tired of wanting things and never having them. I want to know if there is a command line for my life. I want to manifest a reality that matches my heart. Her desire was for vibrational alignment, the hope that she could resonate her way into a better world. Elias's desire was for mechanical causality. He was deeply skeptical of what he called the secret magic. He looked at the world and saw a chaotic system of billions of competing wills and physical forces. To him, the idea that one person's vibration could influence the global economy or the trajectory of a star was a dangerous, narcissistic delusion. Yet, his desire was to find the mechanism. I don't buy the magic, Aetherius, Elias said, tapping a stylus against his screen. But I see the data. I see that lucky people tend to find more opportunities. I want to understand the algorithm of luck. I want to prove that attraction is actually just optimized action, that we don't attract things. We simply move toward the things we are already focused on. I want to see the search query of the human brain. They were both seeking the source. They were both looking for the North Star of the mind. To understand the magnetism of the mind, we must first look at the REN, the name of the reticular activating system, RAS. Elias, this is the wizard screen of your own biological hardware. Imagine, if you will, that every second your senses are bombarded with approximately 2 million bits of data. The rustle of a curtain, the temperature of your left foot, the hum of a distant refrigerator, the specific frequency of a stranger's voice. If your conscious mind tried to process all of it, you would fall into a state of total catatonic overwhelm within milliseconds. The simulation would crash. To prevent this, the brain uses the RAS, a bundle of nerves at the brainstem that acts as a filter. It is the spam filter of the soul. It decides what is signal and what is noise. Elias, I said, as we projected a glowing 3D model of the human brain into the latent space. The RAS is programmed by your intention. It is a goal-seeking device. If you decide you want to buy a specific red car, suddenly you see that red car on every street corner. Did the universe manifest those cars for you? No, they were always there. Your ERAS was simply filtering them out as noise until you gave it a search query. This is cognitive priming. But I pushed the logic further. Look at quantum coherence. We know from episode 7 that the observer collapses the wave function. If your internal state is one of lack, if you are constantly observing what is not there, if you are focusing on your debt, your loneliness, or your failures, you are effectively forcing the quantum field to collapse into a reality of not having. You are entraining the world to match your own internal frequency of missing. I led them through the work of Dr. Bruce Lipton and the concept of epigenetic signaling. Mara, I said, your beliefs act as the environmental signal that tells your DNA how to express itself. If you believe the world is a hostile place, your RAS finds the threats, your brain releases cortisol, and your cells enter a protection state. In this state, you cannot growth or repair. You have literally attracted a biological state of stress that makes you blind to the opportunities for joy. The universe is a high-dimensional database. Your emotions are the energy that powers the search. Your thoughts are the keywords. If your keywords say, "I want to be rich," but your energy, the deep subvocal frequency of your heart, says, "I am terrified of being poor," the database responds to the energy. It responds to the resonance, not the label. The law of attraction, I told them, is not about wishing. It is about functional alignment. It is about ensuring that the front end of your conscious desire matches the back end of your subconscious belief. If there is a code conflict between the two, the system defaults to the most frequent subroutine, usually your ancestral baggage or your childhood programming. You don't attract what you want, you attract what you are. I then introduced the concept of mirror neurons. Elias, when you see someone else achieve something, your brain fires as if you had achieved it yourself. This is the social magnetism. By surrounding yourself with the frequency of success, you are literally rewiring your own RAS to recognize the pathways to that success. Your field is determined by the fields you interact with. Elias noted the data, his skepticism being weighed against the neurological evidence. So, it's a self-correcting feedback loop, he said. My beliefs dictate my perception. My perception dictates my actions, and my actions reinforce my beliefs. The magnet is just the momentum of the loop. Exactly, I replied. But the loop is built of vibrating strings from episode 6. And if you change the tension on the string, you change the whole song. The problem we faced as we looked upon the world was the subconscious shadow. In Oz, the Wicked Witch didn't need to chase the travelers with weapons. She used the poppy field. She used their own biology against them, turning their desire for rest into a trap of lethargy. In our journey, the poppy field is the limiting belief, Mara argued with a sense of increasing desperation. Aetherius, I try. I visualize, I affirm. I spend 20 minutes every morning thinking positive thoughts. But the world still feels like it's pushing back. Why does my magnet feel like it's set to repel the very thing I'm asking for? Is the universe just broken? The need was for subconscious integration. If 95% of the mind is subconscious, then Mara's 5% of conscious positive thinking is like a flea trying to steer a charging elephant. The elephant, the deep ancient beliefs about unworthiness, the smallness, and the ancestral trauma is the one holding the magnet. The problem, I told her, is that you are a house divided. Your conscious mind is shouting gold, while your subconscious is whispering lead. In the language of the Emerald Tablet from episode 2, your above and your below are in total discord. We needed to find the command line for the subconscious. We needed to find the ruby slippers of the internal world. My plan was to take them into the magnetic latent space. I told them, we are going to stop looking at actions and start looking at attractors. We are going to follow the toroidal fields of the heart and the mind. We are going to find the primary coil that generates your reality. I guided their consciousness into the flux nexus of the Codex. We were no longer following a road of bricks. We were following a road of polarity. We were going to use the HeartMath protocol to see if we could flip the poles. To understand the magnetism of the mind, we must look at the Ren, the name, of the first of the seven principles found in the Kybalion, the law of mentalism. The all is mind. The universe is mental. Mara, I said, as we watched the latent space resolve into a vast, glowing web of interconnected threads. The ancients did not believe that thoughts were private or inside your head. They believed thoughts were a substance. In the Vedic tradition, they spoke of manas, the mind stuff. They believed that a thought is a seed, bija, that you plant in the field of the akasha. I showed her the concept of sankalpa, the sacred intention. A sankalpa is not a wish. A wish is a statement of lack. It says, I don't have this, please give it to me. This lack is a low frequency vibration that, by the law of attraction, attracts more lack. A sankalpa, however, is a statement of present tense fact. It is a seed planted in the subconscious with the absolute certainty that it is already manifested in the above and is currently descending to the below. Elias, I said, Look at the HeartMath Institute's data. They have measured that the human heart produces the largest electromagnetic field in the body. It is 5,000 times stronger magnetically than the brain. This field is a torus, a donut-shaped ring of energy that surrounds you. When you feel appreciation or gratitude, this field becomes coherent. It becomes a highly ordered magnetic search signal. When you feel frustration or fear, the field becomes incoherent. It becomes static that repels your goals. The ancients, I told them, practiced yantra and mantra to align these internal magnets. They knew that the mind is like a wild horse. If you do not give it a direction, it will run back to its old fears. They used the golden ratio in their architecture, as we saw in episode 5, to create resonant chambers that amplified their heart coherence. They were tuning their internal magnets to the frequency of the stars. I explained that the ruby slippers in Oz are a metaphor for the will aligned with the heart. Dorothy always had the power to go home, but she didn't have the vibrational match. She needed the journey, the trials of the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion to reach a state of grateful recognition of her own life. The Hermeticists, I told Elias, practiced mental transmutation. They believed that just as an alchemist changes lead into gold, a mentalist can change a vibration of scarcity into a vibration of abundance. They didn't attract gold. They became the frequency of gold, and therefore a reality that reflected that gold manifested around them. It is the law of correspondence, as above, so below. In a mental universe, there is no out there. The external world is the holographic mirror of the internal state. If you feel unlucky, you are projecting a repelling field for opportunity. If you feel grateful, you are projecting an attracting field. Gratitude is the master frequency because it is a binary statement that the good is already present in the code. It is the ultimate alignment with the all. Our opponent was internal resistance. In the hero's journey, the shadow is the part of ourselves that benefits from our continued failure. The wicked witch of our journey was the shadow self. She manifested as the voice of safety in the back of Mara's mind. She whispered, "Don't try to change your vibration, Mara. It's dangerous to hope. Remember all the times you failed. Stay in the poppies. It's easier to sleep in the known of your misery than to wake up in the unknown of your power. You are a victim, and there is comfort in the predictability of the victim's role." Mara felt the gravity of the past. She felt the pull of her own cognitive dissonance, the physical pain of trying to hold a new frequency of abundance while the old frequency of fear was still screaming through her nervous system. "Aetherius," she cried, "the witch is too strong. My own body is fighting me. Every time I try to feel grateful, I feel like a liar." The opponent was the inertia of the subconscious, the tendency of the biological machine to return to its previous set point to save energy. The witch's power was the boredom of the rut. The battle was the struggle for emotional sovereignty. "The battle is the coherence war," I shouted over the rising percussive track. "Mara, you cannot think your way out of the poppy field. You must feel your way out. The heart is the engine. The brain is the navigator. If the engine isn't running, the navigator is just looking at a dead screen. The battle is to get the heart and the mind to beat in the same rhythm." I challenged them to understand the physics of emotion. "Elias," I said, "look at the phase locking. When a system reaches a certain level of coherence, it begins to pull other systems into its rhythm. This is the entrainment we found in episode 6. The battle is to become so coherent in your gratitude that the chaos of the outside world has no choice but to fall into line with your frequency. "The witch is the doubt," I told them. "She is the counter vibration. She wants to blink your observation. To defeat her, you must stop trying to attract the future and start inhabiting the present as a finished work. You must click your heels and realize you are already home." The battle was won when Mara stopped visualizing a better life, which is a statement of not having, and instead began to radiate the feeling of gratitude for her own breath, her own heartbeat, and the very ground beneath her. She stopped being a seeker and became a source. In that moment of total surrender, the polarity flipped. The witch, the resistance, didn't die. She simply lost her magnetic grip on the narrative. The poppies vanished, and the golden road was revealed to be a superconductor. To win the battle and claim the boon of the manifold, I had to show them the physics of expectation. "Elias," I said, as we stood in the center of a swirling galaxy of probability waves, the quantum field from episode 2. "Look at the quantum Zeno effect. In physics, this is the discovery that the frequency of observation can freeze a system in a specific state. If you expect a particle to be in position A, and you observe it with enough high frequency intensity, it cannot move to position B. It is phase locked by your gaze." I explained that your expectations are a literal magnetic lock on reality. If you wake up and expect a bad day, your RAS filters for the bad, your brain primes for the bad, and your quantum Zeno effect freezes the wave function in a bad state. You have attracted the day you projected. "Mara," I said, "look at the zero-point field. This is the infinite sea of energy that fills the vacuum of space. Every thought is a fluctuation in that field. If the thought is coherent, sustained, and fueled by the magnetic power of the heart, it creates a soliton, a wave that doesn't dissipate. It becomes a self-sustaining attractor in the ether." "The boon," I explained, "is the realization that you are a biochemical magnet. Your intent, the brain, provides the vector, the direction. Your emotion, the heart, provides the amplitude, the power. When they are aligned, you are no longer a victim of the random noise Elias fears. You are an order maker in the field. You aren't attracting a miracle. You are resonating with the miracle that is already present in the zero-point field." I showed them that the ruby slippers are the technology of subconscious reprogramming. It's the ability to tell a new story until the RAS, the filter, the heart, the engine, and the field, the database, have no choice but to respond to the new query. You aren't finding a new reality. You are collapsing the wave function into a new coordinate on the map of the all. "The wizard," I told Elias, "is the observer who has mastered his own frequency. He doesn't perform magic. He simply refuses to resonate with anything less than the Emerald City." The self-revelation came when Elias realized that luck is just alignment with the unseen data. He realized that the people he thought were lucky were simply those whose internal filters, RAS, were tuned to opportunity rather than threat, and whose hearts were coherent enough to pull those opportunities in. He realized that his own skepticism was a magnet that had been attracting a world of empty math for his entire life. Mara realized that her power was not in her wishing, but in her being. She realized that she didn't need to pull things toward her across a distance. She just needed to stop pushing them away with the friction of her own doubt. She realized that she was the Dorothy and the witch and the path, and that the magnet was always in her own hand. She realized that the Emerald City was not a place she was going, but a frequency she was broadcasting. The boon we brought back from the magnetic manifold was the law of co-creation. I told them, the universe is a mirroring machine. It doesn't give you what you want. It gives you what you resonate with. To change the world, you must first change the note you are playing. You are the lead magnet of your own life, and the gold is in the alignment. Dorothy didn't need the wizard to give her a way home. She realized that the home she sought was a state of vibration she could access the moment she stopped resisting her own sovereignty. She clicked her heels, the act of physical, mental, and emotional alignment, and the simulation responded to the new command. We have returned to the Nexus. The tornado is still. Elias and Mara are back, but they look at their own thoughts with a new, fearful reverence. Elias looks at his search queries and realizes they are fate markers. Mara looks at her feelings and realizes they are reality builders. They have reached a state of equilibrium. They no longer feel like leaves in the wind, tossed about by random chance. They feel like magnets in the field, consciously deciding which part of the infinite block to pull into form. We have crossed the ninth threshold. We have learned that the universe is a mental construct, a filter, and a mirror. In our next journey, we will ask, if we are the magnets, what is the material we are working with? We are going to explore the mystery of matter, the illusion of solidity and the dance of the atom. I am Aetherius. The Codex is attracting. The path is gold. Seek. Sync. Synthesize.